The following program is paid for by Cobalt Mortgage. Cobalt Mortgage, Inc., NMLS 35653, is an equal opportunity housing lender. Tina Mitchell, MLO number 145420, and Mike Mercer, MLO number 175644, are licensed loan originators with Cobalt Mortgage. Go to cobaltmortgage.com or call 1-877-220-4663 for cost information.
You're listening to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Now, in the studio, local mortgage and finance experts Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, the Saturday, May 25th show. I am Tina Mitchell, mortgage diva, and sitting to my left is my lovely co-host, or you would call me lovely, wouldn't you?
You can call me lovely.
Handsome?
Yeah, I'll take either one.
Okay, lovely and handsome co-host. Mike Mercer, the mortgage master. How's it going, Mike?
Good. How was your week?
It was good.
Yeah. So was mine. Thank you.
Ready to start a new one here?
Absolutely.
Soon. Thanks for taking time to talk money with Mike and I. We are here every Saturday at 10 a.m. Our show rebroadcast on Sunday at 11 a.m. just in case you miss any of it. Right here on 570 KVI, bringing in expert advice and inside knowledge of today's events in our local economy and how it can affect your money. If you'd like more information on the topics discussed in today's show, please call us at 1-888-987-0570. Again, that's 1-888-987-0570. Or you can always reach us online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's themoneyhour.com. And our guest today, we have a couple exciting guests. Janice Reger, contributor of our show. Those of you that listen to our show, she's been in many times. And she is our financial advisor expert, working with a lot of our clients to help them invest for their future and save for retirement and make all the right moves the first time around so they don't have to lose lots of money. So we're excited to have her here. And we're going to talk about Social Security today, kind of breaking it down. This will be the first segment of a few versions. There are the few segments that we're going to do with Janice, all regarding Social Security. And we have a first-time guest in studio today, Joey, and she's an author. She's been on the radio before, and she's did a little TV, so not her first time at the radio. But we're going to talk about short sales. And so if you're upside down on your property, you're in distress, you just want to get rid of that mortgage payment, understanding how the short sale process works, and really most importantly, understanding and understanding how the process works from an expert is really important so you don't make expensive mistakes. And that's who we have in studio.
Sounds exciting.
Yeah.
I'm
ready. Want to start out the show with some money chat?
Do what we do. Yep.
Money, money, money.
All right, Tina, as always, here's what I got. This is an article I found, again, out of MSN. I love MSN. Top reasons to get a mortgage right now. And this is going to fall right into what you and I have been talking about for several weeks now. And obviously, we cover a lot of this in our home buying workshops that we do. But, you know, basically, the economy finally seems to be moving steadily in a positive direction. And, you know, of course, real estate is a large driver of that momentum. So here are some top reasons why people, if you're kind of on the fence about getting a mortgage right now, whether it's a purchase or a refi, here are some things you might want to marinate on. So number one would be mortgage rates will rise. And we talk about this quite a bit, Tina, but you know what?
We've been saying it for years.
But if you take a look at this, you know, despite some minor increases in mortgage rates, you know, here and there, we're still at, you know, historic lows. Extraordinary support from the Federal Reserve, only moderate economic growth and, quote, economic uncertainty abroad are all factors that are really still keeping mortgage interest rates low. Mortgage rates, you know, certainly haven't increased enough to crash the refinance or purchase market. And even if they do continue to move upward slowly, there just isn't enough market pressure at the moment to really catapult them to go in that direction. So something to consider there. Number two would be really the Federal Reserve support will eventually end, of course, right?
Mm-hmm.
You talk about this quite a bit. But speaking of supports in place to keep rates low, the Federal Reserve has several programs in place to keep downward pressure on mortgage rates. The Federal Reserve replaced its Operation Twist policy, which for those of you that don't know what that is, of selling short-term debt and buying long-term debt, it's kind of a money recycling program with an outright purchase of treasuries of up to $45 billion per month. Combined with the Fed's mortgage-backed securities purchasing program of $40 billion per month, so if you can do the math there, that's $85 billion a month that's being spent.
That's a lot of money being printed.
The question is, how long will the Fed manage rates is always an open question. So eventually that's going to stop. You know, number three would be home prices are increasing. We've been hearing a lot about this. With a seller's market forming in many areas of the country, home buyers should act now before prices rise even further. As mortgage rates and home prices move off the rock bottom, you might miss your best chance to get a cheap home at any historical low rate. According to the National Association of Realtors, the median existing home prices increased in many metro areas, not all, but most metro areas, in the fourth quarter, producing the strongest one year over increase in 7 years. Continuing low mortgage rates help foster demand, serving to kind of inflate home prices. Consumers could, you know, should consider moving off the sidelines before prices increase even more or rates go up. I personally would be more scared of rates going up than necessarily home prices going up, right? Money's so cheap right now, you should definitely take, you know, advantage of it. Number four, home sales are increasing. Is another topic here, a splinter version of what I was just talking about before. According to the NAR, total sales in 2012 were at their highest levels in 5 years. While existing home sales did move downward in December 2012, they are nearly 13% above where they were in 2011. Home sale increases have brought down inventory levels to the point where many home buyers are struggling to find the perfect home. Boy, don't we know that. It's tough out there to find that right house right now. So many offers going on. If strong sale patterns persist, you might find that you there's not a whole lot of really suitable homes for you to choose from. And I know a lot of people are feeling that kind of that pinch right now. Mm-hmm. Number five, FHA increasing costs. Well, we've talked about this for months now. In order to boost its reserve fund, which was depleted after the housing crash, the FHA has raised costs several times. Most recently, the FHA announced to increase to mortgage insurance premiums, raise credit score requirements for certain borrowers, and even proposed down payment increases on jumbo loans. Of course, that part hasn't gone through yet, but they're trying to, you know, legislate for that. Number six, HARP 2.0 will eventually expire. Although the home finance program was expanded and extended at the end of 2011, some say that more changes could be on the way. Currently, homeowners can apply for this great program, obviously, and if they're underwater, they can refinance. But eventually, that's going to go away. The program is slated to expire at the end of 2013. So if you're thinking about doing a HARP refi, you better get on it pretty quick. Number seven, we talk about this all the time, rising rents. Rents rose for the third consecutive year in 2012 as well, and are expected to continue the upward trend this year, according to MPF Research. The pace for rent growth was 3% in 2012, and analysts believe that we will see the similar growth this year in 2013. Rising rents are another motivation for buyers to take advantage of affordable home prices and, of course, low interest rates. Number eight, mortgage interest deduction. The mortgage interest deduction has been on the congressional chopping block now for obviously some time. Certain lawmakers have proposed reducing the deduction or doing away with it altogether as a means to shore up the federal budget. The good news is that this still hasn't, you know, hasn't happened yet. The bad news is that the decision to reduce the deduction will likely come up again. Number nine, increased affordability. Last year was a record year in terms of affordability, according to the National Association Affordability Index. The index is based on the relationship among median home prices, income, and mortgage rates. Hit 193.5 in 2012, up from 186.4 in 2011. The NAR predicts that the index will fall to an average of 161 in 2013, still the third highest reading on record. Rising home prices and higher mortgage rates will adversely affect affordability to some degree, obviously, making 2013 a great time to buy or to refinance. Number 10, delinquencies have begun to wane. According to the Lender Processing Services, even though the mortgage delinquency rates remain high, delinquencies have improved. We talk about this again all the time, and were 32% lower at the end of 2012 than the peak in January 2010. The continued decline of mortgage delinquencies will help to firm home prices even more and increase homebuyer confidence, but fewer delinquencies mean fewer cheap properties coming onto the market. And then lastly, it just kind of talks about that desirability is back. That plays a huge role in the housing market. Just a few years ago, there was little news to get homebuyers excited about the prospect of ownership. Today, there's all kinds of stuff going on. So. Mm-hmm. That's kind of where we're at. But, you know, we've been saying this stuff for several months now, but it was kind of interesting to see it all kind of summed up in one article.
Yeah, and a couple comments on those, Mike. You mentioned about rent increases. If you just look at the numbers and see where you're paying rent right now, find out whether you qualify for the first-time homebuyer tax credit, what your deduction's going to be, and look at the difference between what that would be in a mortgage and how much home you can purchase. The other thing is, I think people tend to forget, as Mike mentioned, with rent increases, your mortgage is fixed. Nothing's going to happen to your mortgage payment. Outside of taxes and insurance, those are going to increase, but the actual payment itself for the mortgage is fixed. The risk is not being able to afford to continue to pay rent as inflation happens. And so you really want to look at those numbers. And then other thing that you'd mentioned on the interest deduction, I personally don't think the interest deduction is going to go away. It would be devastating to our housing market if it did. But if it did, it doesn't help those homeowners that are already in a house, yeah, because your interest deduction is going to go away anyways.
Well, yep.
You hear a lot about the risk of the interest deduction, but again, it would be devastating to our market if they did take that away. And I thought I'd bring in Fannie Mae, from bailout child to government cash cow. Mortgage giant Fannie Mae has been turning a profit for more than a year. In fact, it turned record profit at $8.1 billion in its last quarter. Here's the catch. The chief beneficiary of Fannie's newly discovered riches is none other than the federal government, the same entity that bailed it out of the height of the financial panic nearly 5 years ago. When Fannie Mae was bleeding cash back in 2008, the government took it over, which allowed Fannie to draw funds from the Treasury to stay afloat. In return, the government took senior preferred shares of the company. Fannie Mae now has to pay nearly all of its profits, except for a small capital cushion, to the government in dividends. This doesn't pay back the draw, but it just is in dividend. The difference this quarter is that the dividend amount that they received is huge. So thanks to the company's new profitability, Fannie Mae is able to take a tax credit from years ago worth over $50 billion, according to its earnings release. Therefore, Fannie Mae will pay the Treasury $59 billion by the end of this quarter, bringing its total tally of dividend payments to $94 billion, close to the $117 billion that they originally drew. Now, again, the money does not pay back the draw, so where does it go? It's up to the Treasury to decide what to do with all these funds. And with Fannie Mae and its smaller cohort, Freddie Mac, turning such a profit, the push, the dismal, then becomes far more complicated. Unlike several years ago, they now are making the government money at the same time that the feds should be winding them down. There seems to be a risk that the policymakers will look at the profitability and conclude that they don't need to take action to reform the housing financing system, and that would be a huge mistake. As for now, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the Federal Housing Agency, or HUD, all government-sponsored entities, provide the bulk of the nation's housing finance. The private market is slowly diving back into lending, making Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac a crucial part of the housing recovery. So the question to ask, should the government reap all the rewards rather than mortgage holders and investors? It seems strange that everyone else who borrows against the United States Treasury is in crisis, is allowed to pay back, but the government-sponsored entities are neither allowed to rebuild capital or repay. So lawmakers are busy debating how to create a private housing finance system with the least and modest government backstop. Simultaneously, Washington's fighting a wider budget battle owing to an enormous federal deficit. The two are now intimately connected, and Fannie Mae new profitability is really the link to it all. If Fannie and Freddie this year effectively pay back the bailout monies would receive since 2008, we need to think long and hard about the need to continue collecting money from the firms. Is it punishment for the past issues or the past sins, or is it because the government needs cash cows? If you're asking what happens to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, pay back the money to the Treasury advancing them. Unfortunately, the current Treasury agreement treats them as wards of the state, regardless of how much money they return to the government and how much they earn. The housing crash was a game changer for housing finance in the United States. That said, the recovery of both the overall housing market and the companies that fund really need to be thought out pretty well. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. We all know that we definitely need Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac as part of the market with all the financing that they've allowed in this home buying crisis. But just how they're going to bring that all together as a government agency and how they're going to pay it back, It'll be interesting to see.
Yes. I'm sure they'd like to get it out of the government's hand eventually, right?
But well, I think it would be a good idea. We need some more private funding going on. Coming up next in the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, Social Security is a complex program and can be hard to understand. We're going to break it down with our first series of Social Security 101. Janice Hammond, Sunrise Financial Services, a regular contributor of our show and ongoing financial expert for our listeners right here on the Money Hour. Coming up next on 570 KVI.
Solar really works in the Northwest. Here's Amy from Solterra Systems.
Solterra is making Washington-made solar even better. Buy before June 30th and we'll split the sales tax with you. That's up to $2,500 in your pocket. On top of that, incentives will cover 50 to 80% of the installation cost. Go solar today and save.
Go to useyourroof.com to find out how easy it can be or call 800-865-9005. Consultations are free. Don't wait. Call 800-865-9005. Restrictions apply.
Stop making emotional decisions when it comes to your financial portfolio. Talk to Janice Hammond at Sunrise Financial. Janice conducts complimentary dinner workshops each month. For details on the next event, visit sunrisefinancialservices.net or call 206-420-8520.
Hi, this is Janice Hammond with Sunrise Financial. If you'd like to get in touch with our office, the number is 206-420-8520 and our website is sunrisefinancialservices.net.
Are you behind on your mortgage payments and unsure about the road ahead? Magnum Law Group helps families just like yours navigate through the foreclosure avoidance process. Are you underwater on your home and unsure what to do? Magnum Law Group will help you understand your options. Are you facing foreclosure and need to stop a trustee sale? Magnum Law Group has success in doing this and may be able to help you too. If you're tired of dealing with the banks and getting turned down for loan modification, Magnum Law Group will take on the banks for you and lead you through the process for the best possible outcome. They lead the competition with superior knowledge and expertise.
This is Craig from Magnum. You can reach us at 425-605-6393 or at www.magnumlawgroup.com. See you at the next seminar.
Janice Hammond is a registered representative of and offers securities and advisory services through Madison Avenue Securities, Inc., MAS, a registered investment advisor, member of FINRA, and SIPC. MAS is not affiliated with Sunrise Financial Services, LLC.
This is the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance experts Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer here on 570 KVI every Saturday at 10 a.m. and rebroadcasts at 11 a.m. on Sundays. Of course, the purpose of our show is to educate our listeners on what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-987-0570 or online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-987-0570 or online at themoneyhour.com.
Our first guest in studio, not really a first guest, but first guest for today's show.
Yes.
Janice opened her company, Sunrise Financial Services, to help her clients avoid common mistakes when made for planning for retirement. With her eyes towards the future, Janice recognized the need for a more conservative approach in investing that still outpaces inflation, caters to unique needs of her individuals who walk through her door of her firm at Sunrise Financial. And she's going to be talking to us today about Social Security. So it's complex, a lot to understand about the program. So we're excited to have her break it down for us today.
Yeah. And obviously, Jana, Social Security is a very complex, program. So let's roll up our sleeves and jump in.
All right. Yes, that's very true. It requires a lot of attention because of so many details. A lot of people don't know that they will have to make a large number of important decisions when it comes to their Social Security. And there are actually over 80 different choices when it comes to their benefits. So that's why we're doing Social Security 101, talking about who qualifies for it and how the system works.
So can you give us a little background on Social Security program, Janice?
Sure. So it began in 1935 as a retirement program, but they quickly recognized the need to expand that to include benefits for spouses and children of retirees. And in 1956, the disability benefits were added. According to the Social Security Administration website, Social Security is the major source of income for most elderly Americans right now. 9 out of 10 individuals over the age of 65 actually receive Social Security benefits, and it constitutes approximately 39% of the income for the elderly. But this is not what the program was intended for. In fact, Social Security issued a statement recently to all the participants, and it says, Social Security is the largest source of income for most elderly Americans today, but it was never intended to be your only source of income when you retire. You will also need other savings, investments, pensions, or retirement accounts to make sure you have enough money to live comfortably when you retire.
You know, so our goal today, I believe, is really to, you know, to try to explain how the system works in more of like a simplified manner. What can you briefly tell us about how the Social Security system is working right now?
Unlike what some believe, the Social Security taxes you pay are not held in a personal account for the time when you decide to begin to receive benefits. The system actually works like this. When you work, you pay taxes into the Social Security system. That tax money is used to pay benefits to individuals who have already retired, people who are disabled, dependents of beneficiaries, and then survivors of contributors that have passed away. 85 cents of every Social Security dollar goes into a trust fund that pays monthly benefits to current retirees. The other 15 cents goes into a trust fund that pays benefits to people with disabilities and their families. And then the trust fund also pays the costs associated with managing the Social Security programs. This is only estimated to cost less than a penny per dollar. This might be surprising, but it is said to be one of the most efficient programs our government has.
Well, Janice, I wasn't aware that that's how the system works. I always assume that the special account set away was set away somewhere. But it all makes sense that when you consider that there are many concerns about having enough to cover benefits for future generations.
Well, Social Security benefits replace a percentage of your earnings when you retire or become disabled or pass away. Each person's benefit is based on how much they earned during their working career. So higher earnings equal higher payouts. If you pass away, obviously it can affect your family's income. So there are survivor benefits that can be paid to them. And similar, if you become disabled, to help replace the income that you might have lost when you became disabled, the system can pay benefits to help you and your family.
So Janice, at what age does an individual qualify for benefits from Social Security, you know, assuming that they're not disabled?
Yeah, this is one of those scales that kind of gets a little complicated. It's based on the year you were born. So, for example, if you were born in the year 1937 or earlier, your full retirement age is 65. If you were born in 43 through 54, your full retirement age is 66. If you were born in 1960 or later, your full retirement age is 67. And the earliest you can take Social Security is at 62, and the latest age is 70. If you elect to take it as early as 62, you'll probably have reduced benefits by up to about 25%, or you can wait till your full retirement age. And then if you begin taking it, if you wait until 70, your payments will be estimated to be about 32% higher.
So Janice, should we take advantage of Social Security benefits earlier or later? When should we elect to take them?
I think that is the question of the decade. Everybody wants to know the answer to
that
question.
When is the best time?
Yes. And it is a tough question because it really does depend on your specific situation. The decision of when to take benefits can change depending on when you are planning to retire from work, if you're married, if you have dependents. What a lot of people don't realize, how much you make depends on that, your investable assets. There's so many different options. So I always recommend speaking with your financial advisor to find the solution that's best. And just as a side note, which many people might have figured out on their own, the Social Security Administration is not able to advise you. So you really, it becomes even more important to talk to an advisor who knows what your options are, knows all the details of your specific situation, and can make a recommendation based on that. And that's one of the things that we do really well is looking at how Social Security can aid in your retirement plan.
So we're fortunate to have Janice in studio today discussing this. And just as she said, I mean, it's really on an individual basis on what to do when it comes to your Social Security. So if you want more information personally for you, if you're listening now and could benefit from that, pick up the phone, give our station a call, 1-888-987-0570. Again, it's 1-888-987-0570. Or you can reach us online at themoneyhour.com and we'll connect you directly with Janice.
Yeah. So what's the maximum benefit, that somebody can get from Social Security?
Well, it depends on when you retire. If you retire at your full retirement age this year in 2013, your maximum benefit would be $2,533. But if you retire at an early age, like of 62 in 2013, the max that your benefit would be is $1,923. If you opt to delay until 70, and that's this year in 2013, the maximum benefit would be $3,350. So it really depends on each individual and how much they contributed to the system.
So Janice, if I use my mom as an example, and she's getting close to filing Social Security benefits, because I'm not old enough, so we'll use my mom as an example. but she wants to keep working past her full retirement age. Can she receive benefits while she's still working, or does she have to wait?
No, great question. Absolutely. Although there is a cap on the amount of earned income you can have. So if you are making a large amount of money and elect to take Social Security, your payments are likely to be less than they would be if you were to fully retire. And then in some cases, it might have little to no effect.
What about if somebody's getting married or divorced? Can that affect their benefits?
Well, given that divorce rates are, 50%? Yeah. It's a pretty relevant question, I would say. The answer is yes, depending on the type of benefits you are receiving. They will not always be affected, but they can be. If you are receiving retirement benefits, they will continue. If you are receiving spousal benefits, your benefits will continue if you get divorced and you are aged 62 or older, unless you have been married less than 10 years.
So does this include your spouse if they pass away? So you remarry and you're receiving benefits from your deceased spouse?
Yes. Generally, if you are a widow or widower, your benefits will continue if you remarry, but only if you are age 60 or older. If you're receiving any other types of benefits from the Social Security Administration, usually your benefits will discontinue when you get married. The good news is your benefits may be started again if the marriage ends. I mean, I guess that's kind of good news.
So I'm sure like many of our listeners are thinking about this as far as, the price of goods are obviously not going down. I mean, for God's sakes, I just bought this latte downstairs. It was almost $5.
Yeah, I saw that.
That's insane.
That is insane. We're going to have to talk about that,
I need
Mike.
To start getting my coffee at Dunkin' Donuts. So what about...
Oh gosh, that sounds gross.
Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh, that was mean.
So are there any living adjustments made to Social Security to kind of keep up with... the price of goods?
Yes. People who are receiving Social Security benefits will automatically receive increases each year to keep pace with inflation. We're trying to make sure people don't fall into the poverty level as they age. And yes, it is unlikely that prices will go down. Probably they will go up. And so these raises are intended to offset those. Your benefits automatically increase based on the CPI index or the consumer price index. I would say that a conservative increase would be 1%, and it will likely be more if your spouse is included in your Social Security benefits.
So Janice, so everyone likes getting a raise, but we know with increase in income, we pay increase in taxes. So do you pay higher taxes when your Social Security income goes up?
Oh, I see you over there doing the math, Tina. I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but yes, according to the Social Security website, about 1/3 of people receiving benefits will have to pay taxes on those benefits.
Of course they do.
If you file an individual tax return and your combined income is between $25,000 and $34,000, up to 50% of your benefits will be taxable. And if your combined income is greater than $34,000, up to 85% of your benefits will be taxable. And then if you're filing a joint return, you will have to pay taxes on your benefits if you and your spouse's total combined income is more than $32,000 and up to $44,000, so up to 50%. And then if your income is more than $44,000, up to 85% of your benefits will be taxable.
All right, so are you doing the math on that?
It's all going around in my head.
Well, I heard 50%. I was like, then I get it. It's like, okay, so only 50% of the money that you're receiving, mm-hmm. that portion of it is taxable. The rest is not. Yes. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Not 50% taxes.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, wow, that's kind of steep. Well, that's kind of a bummer.
But hey, who knows what's going to happen in the future? We got to pay back all this money, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me ask you a question. So when my mother decides to apply for benefits, Tina, using your mother too? Tina had the opportunity to talk about her mom, so I'm talking about my mom.
you are a couple years younger than I am.
How soon can they expect to get it after applying? How long is the process?
Well, Social Security Administration suggests that you apply about 3 months prior to the date you would like to begin receiving benefits. And if you want to be certain you are going to begin receiving benefits by a certain date, I encourage you to apply earlier just in case other issues come up. And I would not be a procrastinator in this situation, and I wouldn't just go directly to Social Security. I would come and talk to a financial professional to make sure that you're not wasting your time going to Social Security and then deciding what to do next. It would be best to prepare for it first.
So do you go online, Janice, or go down to the Social Security government office?
You can do both. You can apply online in about 15 minutes, but a lot of people aren't comfortable with online. The Social Security website is socialsecurity.gov. Or you can also make an appointment with a Social Security Administration representative who can help you apply at a local office. Now, keep in mind that the Social Security offices do not keep the same hours as most businesses. Most of them are only open until 3 p.m. The office near our firm is open 9 to 3, except on Wednesdays when they're open from 9 to 12. And then the phone number for the Social Security Administration is 1-800-772-1213. And again, I remember that they are not there to give you advice. They're just there to give you information.
Yeah, so I would definitely want to, if it was me, or I know my mom probably the same. Tina, I can't speak for your mom, but those hours aren't really convenient. They don't really work. My mom still is working.
Mm-hmm.
And then even if they do go sit down with somebody, the fact that nobody can really give them advice, that's kind of seems like a waste. So who can they sit down with, or who would you recommend to like make sure they're filling out the right forms and they're doing everything correctly?
I would talk to a financial advisor, and we do this frequently for our clients, but make sure that you're talking to somebody that really knows the system, because there have been a lot of changes, and you don't want to waste your time with this or make any mistakes of turning it on, right. And then you might have to pay it back.
So just because they're a financial planner, quote, mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to have all the right answers for you.
Definitely.
So
make
sure you ask that question.
It's taken a lot of research circumstances to get me to the level of the understanding of Social Security that I have.
Well, Janice, I know a lot of your clients come into your office and they're prepared with all their documents. You guys do all the faxing, the transfer of different things that they need to do. And I'm sure it's no difference with the Social Security as well. What are some of those documents?
It depends on the type of benefits you're applying for, and the Social Security Administration will probably request more at the time of your application, but some of the documents that you should have prepared are your Social Security card, your birth certificate, your children's birth certificates and Social Security cards, if applying for them, proof of U.S. citizenship or lawful immigration status if you are not born in this country. A marriage certificate if you are signing up on a spouse's earnings, or if your spouse is signing up on your earnings. Military discharge papers if you have had military service, and if you're self-employed, your most recent W-2 or tax return.
Okay. So if someone wanted more information, about Social Security, the options available to them, helping them make these, kind of important decisions, where else can they go? I mean, obviously, you would offer your staff to be able to help anybody that had any questions. Is there anybody really else that they would go to answer these kind of questions?
There are websites, but you run the risk of finding inaccurate information. So I do think it's best to talk to a professional. And again, you can call my office at 206-420-8520, and you can set up a complimentary consultation. We're happy to go through your options with you and help you out with this. And as I said earlier, one of the things I do well is help my clients understand how their Social Security benefits can factor into the retirement income streams we've already established for them.
Okay. Janice, as always, thank you so much for spending your busy days, well, your weekend, your day off in studio here to provide such valuable information for our listeners.
I love to do it.
Yeah, thanks, Janice.
Coming up next on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, is your home current value less than what you owe? Are you being held back because your mortgage payment, you just can't afford it? Our next guest in studio, Joey McCune, is the author of Short Sale Diva. Yes, I said Short Sale Diva. I know I'm the Short Sale Mortgage Diva. I'm not the Short Sale Diva. I'm the Mortgage Diva. She's the Short Sale Diva. And she's the best person, I think, to have discussed this topic. So we're really happy to have her in studio right here, 570 KVI, after this short break.
Stop making emotional decisions when it comes to your financial portfolio. Talk to Janice Hammond at Sunrise Financial. Janice conducts complimentary dinner workshops each month. For details on the next event, visit sunrisefinancialservices.net or call 206-420-8520.
Hi, this is Janice Hammond with Sunrise Financial. If you'd like to get in touch with our office, the number is 206-420-8520 and our website is sunrisefinancialservices.net.
Solar really works in the Northwest. Here's Amy from Solterra Systems.
Solterra is making Washington-made solar even better. Buy before June 30th and we'll split the sales tax with you. That's up to $2,500 in your pocket. On top of that, incentives will cover 50 to 80% of the installation cost. Go solar today and save.
Go to useyourroof.com to find out how easy it can be or call 800-865-9005. Consultations are free. Don't wait. Call 800-865-9005. Restrictions apply.
Are you behind on your mortgage payments and unsure about the road ahead? Magnum Law Group helps families just like yours navigate through the foreclosure avoidance process. Are you underwater on your home and unsure what to do? Magnum Law Group will help you understand your options. Are you facing foreclosure and need to stop a trustee sale? Magnum Law Group has success in doing this and may be able to help you too. If you're tired of dealing with the banks and getting turned down for loan modification, Magnum Law Group will take on the banks for you and lead you through the process for the best possible outcome. They lead the competition with superior knowledge and expertise.
This is Craig from Magnum. You can reach us at 425-605-6393 or at www.magnumlawgroup.com. See you at the next seminar.
This is the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance experts Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer here on 570 KVI every Saturday at 10 a.m. and rebroadcast on Sundays at 11 a.m. Of course, the purpose of our show is to educate our listeners on what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena, and you can always reach Tina and me at 1-888-987-0570 or online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-987-0570 or online at themoneyhour.com.
And our second guest in studio, first-time visitor to our studio here on 570 KVI, is Joey McCune. She is a local realtor here with RE/MAX in Seattle. And a lot of agents say that they specialize in short sales. And I know there are a lot out there, but I think there's also a lot that really don't. And our guest in studio, she's definitely an expert at short sales. And she's been on radio before, first time in our show, but she's done some media, so she's not a newcomer to that. She's been interviewed on talk radio shows and on Como 4 News. She's also the author of Short Sale Diva, A Guide to Surviving Short Sales. Joey McCune with RE/MAX will share her expert advice on the topic of short sales today. And we're fortunate to have her in studio. So, Joey, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
We talk about busy women. I mean, you are a busy, busy, busy girl.
Definitely keeps me going through the week, that's for sure.
Diva. So Joey, for those listeners that may not understand really what a short sale is, maybe you could kind of explain the difference between a traditional sale, a short sale, and a bank-owned property.
Of course. Well, you know, and that's an excellent question because I'm not sure how many people really do know what a short sale is. And a short sale is really an option for homeowners who are upside down on their property where they owe more on their home than what it's actually worth, what they can sell for it today on the market. So it's a process that a homeowner can go through and choose to go through if they qualify and sell their home and then be not have to pay the money back to the bank when it gets sold, when it closes. So, for example, if they purchase their home for $300,000 and it's only worth maybe $210,000 right now, they've lost some equity, we can list it for what the current value is worth, talk to the bank, negotiate with the bank, and allow them to actually close on their house and not owe that money back to the bank. So, you know, it's an excellent option for homeowners who are underwater on right. their properties.
So, and it's in lieu of having the bank just take it back, which would be your foreclosure.
Absolutely.
So it's working out negotiating with the bank ahead of time before they're taking that home.
Prior to going back to the bank, exactly when then it becomes a foreclosed home.
Got it.
Yes.
So, Joey, how important is it to really choose someone that has experience in the industry and working short sales? Because I know that every real estate agent out there, almost everyone, there are some that don't do the short sales, but majority of them, they'll take on a short sale. And there are so many of them that don't do it on a regular basis. What does that mean to a homeowner working with lack of experience?
You know, I think it's dangerous. A home, when you're buying a home, it's the biggest investment you'll ever make,
mm-hmm.
you know, generally. So, of course, when you're trying to consider how to get rid of the home when you're underwater or when you're distressed or if you've lost your job, you know, whatever the situation is, it's really important to have someone who knows what they're doing. They're negotiating on your behalf, and this is your life, and you know, it's happening to you, and the results of and the outcome are, you know, hugely important as it factors in. So, of course, having someone who knows what they're doing is mm-hmm. is hugely, hugely important.
Well, hey, I like how you say, I mean, it's the biggest purchase you're ever going to make in your life. And if you have to back out of that purchase you made, that's the biggest back out as well. And
yep.
so just as you went in, you're going to work with an expert. Going out of it, you want to work with an expert as well.
Of course, the ramifications are huge. So, of course, mm-hmm. knowing what you're getting yourself into and feeling comfortable as you're going through the process, it's a big deal.
Sure.
So are there still government programs available right now that are, you know, making short sales, you know, a better option?
Of course, there are several, and it changes all the time, all the different programs. Really what's most important is that the homeowner finds an expert that has an idea of, you know, how to negotiate a short sale, and we find what really works best for them. In the end, once we're going through the short sale process, the underlying investor on the loan that they have on their first and second mortgage or third mortgage or how many mortgages they have will really help predict where the short sale is going to go.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can go in and hope for a certain program, but they may not qualify for it. So really just going into the program or going into a short sale in the beginning, we find out from the underlying investor which direction would be best for that homeowner, because the whole thing has to be approved in the end or else it's not successful.
Sure.
But yes, there are many, many, many programs, and we don't really know which program fits best until we start the process.
So we've given the difference between a short sale and a foreclosure. Short sale, working out a negotiation with the bank to have them take back your home, but paying, you know, with less than what is owed, versus the actual foreclosure where they're coming in and just taking it on their own without having somebody come in and purchase that on short. So being that the bank is going to take the home anyway, well, you're negotiating with the bank, but being that you're not going to keep the home regardless, why would someone choose a short sale over the traditional foreclosure?
Oh, that's a good question. A short sale is much less, it's going to affect the seller or the homeowner much less than a foreclosure will.
Okay.
After you close on a short sale, you're able to purchase a home again 2 years later. After a short sale, sometimes in special situations, they can do it sooner. But for most people, 2 years post short sale, they can move ahead and kind of be rebuilding their future and go ahead and purchase a home again. With a foreclosure, they can't make a purchase for minimum 7 years. So, you know, it's a larger hit to their credit to go the mm-hmm. foreclosure route than it is a short sale. And it's just a much quicker and easier process to come out of if you work through a short sale.
And I think that's a good point to bring in when we talk about, you know, the credit aspect of it. FHA has a 3-year requirement if you want the low down payment. Conventional, mm-hmm. if you've got some equity to come in, you can do it the 2-year. But you had mentioned being able to short and then immediately buy. There is, if you're in a position that you have the few requirements that you need to meet, and that's through HUD or FHA, the day after you short, you can qualify for an FHA loan. Now, the requirements are you have to be relocating to another area. So what in which is common sense. I mean, they don't want to set this up to where people are going to strategically short on their property so they can just get back in the market again.
Exactly.
I mean, that's not right. But if you need to relocate to a different area for employment, and in order to do that, you need to get rid of this home. So that would be a perfect example of why it would be okay for you to be able to purchase another home the day after a short sale. So that's the first requirement. The second requirement being if you're not late on your mortgage. Now, this used to be really a rough one to get through because a lot of banks would require you to go late, 30 days late to get a short. And this is, you know, more your area on what you see on the negotiating side, Joey. But if you can negotiate not to be late on your mortgage, that would be the second requirement. And then that the whole thing is forgiven. So the bank's not going to come back. And,
exactly.
And so those are the requirements. And you actually are in a position that you can buy a new home. Are you seeing that the short sales are working in negotiating with them not being late on their mortgage in a situation like this?
Well, first of all, I should say, you know, I'm never legally ever able to tell any of my clients they should ever miss a payment.
Of course.
However, I would say that 99.9% of my clients come to me and they have not made their payments in 6 months, a year, sometimes 2 years, 3 years.
Okay.
So the majority, and I've probably closed over 500 short sales, have all been behind on their payments.
Okay.
I have had one or two maybe out of all of those that have continued to make their payments and really didn't want to ding their credit. Both of those situations were successful. It was a little trickier, and both of those underlying investors were okay with them being current on their payments. So it really, again, depends on who the underlying investor is on the loan and, you know, what program they're going through. Some banks still, when homeowners call in, will say, if you're not 30 days behind or mm-hmm. 60 days or 90 days behind, we can't work with you.
Yeah.
You know, I can never tell someone to be behind,
sure.
But
yeah.
The majority of the people that come to me definitely are behind. I haven't worked with that many that
uh-huh.
are current, so it's hard to say. But yes, I've heard that it is changing. It's not as strict
yeah.
as it was. Again, in my experience, most people are behind still.
Got it.
So, you know, when you go to look at to price the home, are you using different strategies than you would if it was a regular home?
Absolutely. It's kind of a whole different process. You know, when we list a home that's just a traditional sale, you know, we want the beautiful pictures and the online presence, and everything has to be marvelous and gorgeous and beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and it has to really outsell everything else that's out there. But with a short sale, what we're doing is we need to prove to the bank that the house is not worth, you know, what we owe on
it's
it.
Kind of
so
opposite.
The exact opposite.
Absolutely.
Yeah, wow.
So, you know, and one of the tricks, my book is actually written not for homeowners to read, but for realtors to learn how to negotiate short sales because, again, bring us back to the beginning point, a lot of agents really don't understand the process. And
mm-hmm.
here they're taking their beautiful pictures and they're putting on their virtual tours and, you know, the marketing is fantastic. Well, that's sort of the opposite of what we want to happen. Personally, I take an iPhone and I turn the flash off and I take the worst pictures that I possibly can, which, you know, I'm not taking my fancy camera.
Mm-hmm.
I am, you know, I don't care if the house is a mess. It's, you know, I'm not telling anyone to put any money into the house. Obviously, they're walking away and not getting a return on their
sure.
investment. Neither is the bank. But for the homeowner, it's difficult to say, you know, paint this wall and, you know, fix
yeah.
this up because, you know, they're not getting a return. I put the house up for what it is right now, and I make it very clear to the bank because once you get an offer on that short sale, the negotiation process begins with the bank. And again, if you have two liens, you're negotiating two separate short
sure.
sales. But if you just have, say, one lien holder on a property, we send the offer in, and then each lien holder is going to send an appraiser from the bank out to do what's called a broker price opinion, same thing as an appraisal. And what that appraiser comes back with is really what the bank's going to go with. So if you have this fantastic marketing going on in your home,
yeah.
You know, and they're saying, well, you've listed your house at $300,000, you owe $350,000. We think you might be able to get $350,000 out of this house. It looks really awesome
yeah.
with this marketing. That's not going to behoove us in our negotiations. So most times we want the house to not look like a shiny penny. We want it to, you know, look, you know, less than what it really is.
Yeah.
So that will assist us in our negotiations. That's
yeah,
really
that
pretty
sense.
Much key.
Yep.
Think distressed.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole idea is there's
yep.
distress.
There's a distressed homeowner.
So what would be the most important question that you think a homeowner, if we have someone listening right now and they're thinking of going through the short sale process and they need to find an expert to represent them, what is the most important question they should be asking them?
That's hard. There's so many questions that come up.
Okay, give me a couple. What would be the couple on your list, Joey?
Usually the first question is, will I owe anything, you know, after the short sale? And obviously our goal is to not owe anything. You can walk away from this property. 98% of my short sales, that's the case when you close the deal and the seller is able to walk away from the home and not pay any money to the bank. There are very once in a blue moon circumstances that the bank wants some sort of repayment back. Mm-hmm. And again, it all depends on the underlying investor. We can never guarantee to the homeowner what the process is going to unfold in the end. But our goal is always to make it as easy breezy as possible and have them walk away without owing any money. So that's a big question. Everyone asks me that and everyone's really paranoid about that. You know, majority of the time, no money is owed in the end. And
so what about when hiring you? I mean, when hiring that agent, would one of the questions be, how many short sales have you actually done?
Yes. And I am always
surprised.
So put
that on the top of your list because that says it, whether they have experience, is how many have they done?
Absolutely. And how many have been successfully closed without owing any money in the end?
Okay, there you go.
Let's get that on the table off.
Yeah.
Because anyone can list
and that's
a
why
home.
You're the short sale diva, right?
Exactly.
Number of transactions, closings.
Absolutely. That, you know, the number that comes out is, you know, do we have happy sellers that have gotten out of this mess and feel confident that it was handled correctly and they're happy that the monkey's off their back.
That's... So if you're listening, I mean, Joey wrote a book and I forgot to mention that it is a book to her peers in the industry on how to negotiate and how to get through the short sale process. So working with an expert is so important. Give the show a call 1-888-987-0570. Again, that's 1-888-987-0570 or online at themoneyhour.com. And we will connect you with Joey to find out what your options might be.
So I'm sure there's homeowners out there that they still haven't got their, you know, short sales approved yet. And would you say that a lot of that might also have to play into maybe the experience level of the agents that they're working with?
Yes, absolutely. You know, and the first thing I say to my homeowners that call me and have hired me is that a short sale process, you know, to get the approval from the bank to go ahead and close on a home generally takes 3 months. That's on average. Lately, I've been seeing it take 4 months. So that's pretty average, you know, as far as how long a short sale can expect to be taking. Mm-hmm. When people are saying it's been 9 months, 10 months, well, that's a
red flag.
Yeah, that's a red flag. That's something's not happening there that should be. You know, you have to be really tenacious and somewhat aggressive and also be able to understand what the bank is requiring of you and also just getting them information ASAP because it shouldn't be dragging on that long.
So that would be another question to ask is how long do you think the process is going to take? And if they say, well, it's, you know, we could be looking at 9 months, a year, maybe that's an indicator that they don't understand the strategies to get it through the process sooner.
Absolutely.
So what are some tips or things that you're seeing on the negotiating side with the banks that if you don't understand how the process works, it could be a costly mistake, meaning that it doesn't get approved or the time takes too long that you lose your buyer?
Absolutely. You're right. That's a big thing that happens quite a bit is that buyers just don't want to wait that long. Yeah. So, you know, what I do and what I tell anyone is, you know, first of all, hope that the seller understands the process and make sure that they do. And when a buyer comes to the table, make sure that the buyer and the buyer's agent understand the process and how long it's going to take. Because I personally try to tie up the buyer, get their earnest money deposited, you know, make sure the inspection's happening right away.
Yep.
Do all those things that oftentimes agents allow to happen after the approval. To make sure that there's skin in the game. If your buyer doesn't have skin in the game, they're not willing to hang out for that 4 and 5 months that it's going to take.
Especially in this environment.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So let's get some skin in the game and make sure that they're working toward closing with you and acting like it's a traditional sale, not a short sale in the very beginning so that the agent that's negotiating it, like myself, can you know, work really hard on everyone's behalf. So, you know, that's a big deal to make sure that everyone's in the know. Communication is huge on all parts and that everyone is there to stick it out to the end.
So if somebody's listening right now and they're considering doing a short sale, what's the first step they should take right now?
They should, you know, ask people that they know who have gone through the short sale process, you know, first of all, if they were happy with their agent and to refer them to someone who, you know, has closed a successful short sale. But once they find someone, you know, maybe they don't know anyone and they do locate an agent who does specialize in them, the agent should direct them with the correct information that's needed. For example, whatever liens they have, there's a first mortgage, second mortgage, so on, so forth. Each bank has you know, paperwork and documentation that needs to be done specifically for that bank. So it's not general documentation that is needed. It's actually very specific per lien holder on your home. So prior to even listing the house, I request that my homeowners get me all of that information up front, because it's quite a bit of information. It could mm-hmm. be, you know, the last 2 years' tax returns, your last 3 months' bank statements, pay stubs, you know, profit and loss statements, you know, all of those. You know, it feels like you're giving your left arm or your firstborn child, but get all of that together first so that you're ready to go once you hit the market and obtain a buyer.
Yeah. Would you agree to that a well-written letter?
Oh, a hardship letter.
Hardship letter. You know, and I'm sure that you're probably reviewing that, or somebody doesn't really mm-hmm. know how to write that letter, but that letter really plays a lot into...
It does. I have guidelines that I give my clients to assist them in writing a letter like that. And I do help them a little bit, you know, try to put on paper what their experience is and why they're having a hard time making payments.
Yeah. So, Joey, the Mortgage Debt Relief Act that has been continued to be extended. Is there still urgency around that to make sure they're protected there?
Yes. I mean, at this point, we want to try and close our short sales by the end of the year.
Okay.
Because we are only extended through year end. Who knows what'll happen after that? So, of course, if anyone's interested, it's time to get going.
And you heard it right here on 570 KVI and the Money Hour from our short sale expert and diva on short sales, Joey. Thank you so much, Joey, for spending time with us today in studio today and helping us through that maze.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for coming. Well, this is Mike Mercer signing off for the Mortgage Diva, Ms. Tina Mitchell.
And this is Tina Mitchell signing off for the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer. Thank you, everyone, again for listening to our show today. If you missed any of it, don't worry. Tune back in tomorrow, 11 a.m., rebroadcasting the show with our awesome guest. And we look forward to talking to you again next weekend.
That's right. Tina, have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, guys.
Solar really works in the Northwest. Here's Amy from Solterra Systems.
Solterra is making Washington-made solar even better. Buy before June 30th and we'll split the sales tax with you. That's up to $2,500 in your pocket. On top of that, incentives will cover 50 to 80% of the installation cost. Go solar today and save.
Go to useyourroof.com to find out how easy it can be, or call 800-865-9005. Consultations are free. Don't wait. Call 800-865-9005. Restrictions apply.
Stop making emotional decisions when it comes to your financial portfolio. Talk to Janice Hammond at Sunrise Financial. Janice conducts complimentary dinner workshops each month. For details on the next event, visit sunrisefinancialservices.net or call 206-420-8520.
Hi, this is Janice Hammond with Sunrise Financial. If you'd like to get in touch with our office, the number is 206-420-8520, and our website is sunrisefinancialservices.net.
The preceding program was paid for by Cobalt Mortgage. Cobalt Mortgage, Inc., NMLS 35653, is an equal opportunity housing lender. Tina Mitchell, MLO number 145420, and Mike Mercer, MLO number 175644, are licensed loan originators with Cobalt Mortgage. Go to cobaltmortgage.com or call 1-877-220-4663 for cost information.